This was a fateful event in monetary history because the precedent has been followed ever since. In Europe and in America, the central banks and their favored associate banks have always known that their partners in government will come to their aid when they get into trouble. They do not worry about that at all. They have been released from the need for honesty or restraint in their business practices. And this is the root of the economic crisis that we are facing in the United States today. Now, this master plan of the cabal was also seen in the French Revolution. That is a subject all by itself. It can be said, however, that the popular image of the French Revolution is not very accurate. Most textbooks describe the French Revolution as the popular uprising of the masses against a hated regime. This does not turn out to be quite true, to put it mildly. The popular uprising of the masses was engineered, and there was a lot of maneuverings behind the scenes, and it was not that at all. Getting back to Professor Carol Quigley and his book, Tragedy and Hope, he touches on this subject on page 515, and this is what he says, quote, "At that date, financial power was in the hands of about 10 or 15 private banking houses, whose founders in most cases had come from Switzerland in the second half of the 18th century. These bankers, all Protestant, were deeply involved in the agitations leading up to the French Revolution. When the revolutionary violence got out of hand, they were the chief forces behind the rise of Napoleon, whom they regarded as the restorer of order. As a reward for this support, Napoleon, in 1800, gave these bankers a monopoly over French financial life by giving them control of the new Bank of France." So there's just a little quick glimpse. We see how these financial powers can be behind the scenes, manipulating things as massive as a French Revolution and gaining complete control over the economic life of a nation as a result of it. Those same forces remain in control of the economic life of France today, even though the central bank theoretically has been nationalized by the French government. If you look at it very carefully, you'll see that the same cabal is very much in control. Now, any discussion of Napoleon or the central banks must lead eventually to the name Rothschild. It was Meyer Amschel Rothschild who said, "Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who writes the laws." In his biographical study entitled The Rothschilds, Frederick Morton concluded that the Rothschild dynasty had, and these are his words, "conquered the world more thoroughly, more cunningly, and much more lastingly than all the Caesars before or all the Hitlers after them." Now, the dynasty was begun in Frankfurt, Germany, in the middle of the 18th century by Meyer Amschel Bauer, who was the son of a goldsmith. Now, Meyer became a clerk in the Oppenheimer Bank, which was located in Hanover, and eventually was promoted to junior partner there. And after his father died, he left the banking house of Oppenheimer and returned to his home in Frankfurt. Now, over the door hung a red shield with an eagle as identification for the family business. Now, the German words for red shield, I believe, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Rothschild. So he changed his name from Bauer to Rothschild, as we call it today, and added 5 gold arrows held in the talons of the eagle to represent his 5 sons. Amazing sons. The Rothschild fortune began with the practice of what is called fractional reserve banking, which we had to skip over in our preliminary session. But basically, that boils down to the creation of gold receipts, promissory notes, which had no gold behind them. That's the bottom line. And then the collection of interest on those worthless receipts. It's an ancient practice well honored in the banking circles. The Rothschilds became prime lenders to governments all over Europe. His sons set up operations in all the financial centers of Frankfurt, Vienna, London, Naples, and Paris, and they curried loans to heads of government and soon became prime lenders, to such countries as England, France, Italy, and Germany. They were the financial power of Europe at that time. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're not just talking about ancient history. This dynasty is very much alive and well today. Nathan Rothschild opened up the London office of N.M. Rothschild & Sons in 1804. Today, almost 200 years later, at 10:30 every weekday morning, the international price of gold is fixed by five men sitting absolutely alone in a private room at the London offices of N.M. Rothschild & Sons. The cabal has an incredible continuity. Now, they say that one picture is worth a thousand words. Then I suppose that's true, but then one example is worth a thousand explanations. And I think the best example that could be offered would be the Battle of Waterloo in June of 1815 and the consequences. Now, Napoleon had come to power, as you recall, with the help of the cabal. But now that he was in power, he was a threat to the balance of power. The balance of power means that nobody is very much stronger than anyone else, and therefore wars can go on indefinitely. If you've got one absolute strong man, that's Pax Romana. That's peace. You can't have that. So Napoleon was becoming too strong. He was threatening to conquer all of Europe, so they had to oppose Napoleon. That's the basic thing. Now, Napoleon saw this clearly because he knew these people. And toward the end of his career, he wrote these words, quote, "When a government is dependent for money upon bankers, they and not the leaders of the government control the situation. Since the hand that gives is above the hand that takes, money has no motherland, financiers are without patriotism and without decency, their sole object is gain." It's not surprising, therefore, that the House of Rothschild was active on behalf of England in this case against France, but not out of patriotism toward England, but for gain. And this was brought to focus in the campaign between Napoleon and Wellington. This was perhaps the greatest single act on behalf of the Rothschilds, which was to deliver 800,000 pounds worth of gold to Wellington, who was attempting to build and equip an army in Portugal and in the Pyrenees Mountains between Spain and France. Now, to accomplish this, the gold had to move from England through enemy territory, right through France, to get to Wellington. Now, this wasn't too difficult for the Rothschilds to do because they were actively engaged in smuggling operations on a grand scale, I might add. I mean, ships loaded. They could get through almost any national boundary line because their red shield was recognized and respected by all governments. Don't forget, they were lending to all governments. They were friends to all governments. They were enemies of none. And in fact, all governments depended upon the Rothschilds not only for financial support, but also in some cases for supplies. So it was not a particularly difficult thing for the Rothschilds to move anything through enemy territory because to them there is no such thing as enemy territory. A fact I hope you will not forget when we're talking about later events. At a dinner party in later years, Nathan Rothschild was rather boastful, and I can picture him sitting back in his chair, perhaps touching his fingertips together, and these were his words, quote, "The East India Company had 800,000 pounds worth of gold to sell. I went to the sale and bought it all." Just like that. "I went to the sale and bought it all. I knew the Duke of Wellington must have it. The government sent for me and said they must have the gold. I sold the gold to them, but they didn't know how to get it to the Duke in Portugal. I undertook all of that and sent it through France. It was the best business I have ever done," end quote. Incredible, isn't it? Well, the best part, though, came after the Battle of Waterloo. You see, the battle itself was crucial to the financial standing of the British bonds. Just picture for a moment what would have happened had Napoleon been victorious. Here was England, already in debt so far that they could never hope to repay it, Rothschilds and others. And everybody is holding these government bonds, and England supposedly is paying interest on them. If they had lost the war, those bonds would have plummeted in value. Nobody would want them, because the credibility of England's financial power to pay on them would have been seriously questioned. On the other hand, if Wellington were to be victorious, the bonds would surge up in value. They were hovering somewhere, you know, in between, because nobody knew what was going to happen. But had he been victorious, they would have surged upward, and there would have been confidence again, because England would surely be one of the dominant military and economic forces in Europe. So, in this case, having prior information is pretty important. It was a well-known fact, because of Rothschild's ability to get through lines, and because they had a network of messengers all over Europe, it was a fact that Rothschild's messengers moved through Europe faster than anyone else, governments included. And it was generally expected that Rothschild, Nathan Rothschild in London, would be the first man to know the outcome of the Battle of Waterloo. And in fact, that is what happened. Rothschild's messenger arrived in London a full day before the official messenger of the British Army. And so when Rothschild went to the bond market in London on the morning of June 20th, all eyes were fixed on him. And he went to his pillar, where he had a little table where he normally did his trading, and he was observed to be very, very dejected. He didn't want to talk to anybody. He was very sad. He was holding his head. He was shaking his head. He was depressed, obviously. And then he started to sell. And then he sold some more. And the word went through the crowd like wildfire. Nathan is selling. He knows. Wellington lost. Well, you know what happened. Within a matter of hours, the floor fell through the market. And everybody was selling their bonds for whatever price. Didn't make any difference. But you must realize that in order to sell, someone must buy. And who was buying? Well, they didn't know who these people were who were buying. There were new faces out there. Who are these idiots in there? Well, you know the answer already. They were Rothschild agents buying up all the debt of the English, of the British government. And by the end of that day, ladies and gentlemen, the Rothschilds had purchased English debt, and they did this at a fraction of what those bonds were worth. From that day forward, the Bank of England, England's financial life, and in fact, England itself, were effectively under control of the House of Rothschild. It was Nathan Rothschild himself who said, quote, "I care not what puppet is placed upon the throne of England. The man who controls Britain's money supply controls the British Empire, and I control the British money supply." End quote. That says it all. All right, I have a very interesting question, kind of a philosophical question that leads to some practical answers. How is it that the cabal can induce governments to borrow money, to get into debt, and then to continue paying that debt through the Mandrake mechanism? And after all, the government has the power of armies, and it can simply tell the financiers to go take a hike. And yet, this doesn't happen. Why not? The answer to that question is what I call the Rothschild formula. And this was worked out in 18th century Europe and perfected in the intervening years. Now, what I'm going to read to you verbatim, I'm going to read it verbatim because it took me a long time to reduce it down into very succinct language. I put myself in the position of what I would do if I were in charge or the head honcho of the cabal, and I had to explain it to one of my proteges so that he could understand it and continue on after me. How could I boil it down into a very succinct statement of procedure? And I came up with five instructions. So I'm speaking now as though I were advocating the Rothschild formula. One, war is the ultimate discipline to any government. If it can successfully meet the challenge of war, it will survive. If it cannot, it will perish. All else is secondary. The prosperity of its citizens and the solvency of its treasury will be quickly sacrificed by any government in its primal act of self-survival. Two, all that is necessary, therefore, to ensure that a government will maintain or expand its debt is to involve it in war, or the threat of war. The greater the threat, and the more destructive the war, the greater the need for debt. Three, to involve a country in war, or the threat of war, it will be necessary for it to have enemies with credible military might. Now, if such enemies already exist, all the better. If they exist but lack military strength, it will be necessary to provide them the money to build their war machine. If an enemy does not exist at all, then it will be necessary to create one by financing the rise of a hostile, warlike regime. Four, the ultimate obstacle is a government which refuses to finance its wars through the Mandrake mechanism. Although this seldom happens, when it does, it will be necessary to encourage political opposition, insurrection, or revolution to replace that government from the inside with one that will. The assassination of heads of state will play an important role in this process. Five, no nation can be allowed to remain militarily stronger than its adversaries, for that could lead to peace and a reduction of debt. To accomplish this balance of power, it may be necessary to finance both sides of the conflict. Wherever possible, neither side should be allowed a decisive victory or defeat. The objective is perpetual war. Now, I believe that says it all. And any protege of mine in the cabal who didn't understand that would soon be on the outside. It's very clear, and I think that if you hold that formula in mind, at least as a possibility, and take a look at history, the meaning of history suddenly becomes quite different than it had before. So let's do a little bit of that as time permits. We shall briefly examine the Rothschild formula as applied to four major periods of conflict: 18th century England, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, and both world wars. Now, in 18th century England, Europe had always been at war, but not until the arrival of central banking and fiat money did it become institutionalized at such a high and consistent level. For example, the following incredible record occurred starting precisely with the formation of the Bank of England for the specific purpose, as you recall, of financing a war. That was the reason for the creation of the world's first central bank, was to finance a war. Okay, this is the record of England starting from that point. 1689 to 1697, the War of the League of Augsburg, King William's War. 1702 to 1713, the War of Spanish Secession, Queen Anne's War. 1739 to 1742, the War of Jenkins' Ear. 1744 to 1748, the War of Austrian Secession, King George's War. 1754 to 1763, the French and Indian War. 1793 to 1801, the War against Revolutionary France. 1803 to 1815, the Napoleonic Wars. Now, you add all that up. In the 126 years between 1689 and 1815, England was at war 63 of them. Now that is one out of every 2 years in actual combat. The others were spent preparing for combat. A total war society. The mark of the Rothschild formula is evident in that period. The hand of the cabal was often seen financing both sides of these conflicts. There usually were no decisive victories or defeats, and the only tangible result was expanded government debt for all parties on all sides of the conflict. Now let's take a look at the Bolshevik Revolution, another example of the Rothschild formula, with particular attention to item number 4 on that list, which was the overthrow of a government that is not willing to finance its wars through the Mandrake mechanism, which was true of Russia at that time. Now, this is another one of those myths of history. The Bolshevik Revolution is often presented as an uprising, a popular uprising of the downtrodden masses against an oppressive government, just like the French Revolution. But the facts are, ladies and gentlemen, the planning, the leadership, and the financing came almost entirely from outside Russia, mostly from financiers in Britain, Germany, and particularly the United States. This really started with Jacob Schiff and the Russo-Japanese War of 1904. Much of Japan's funding for that war came from the financial house of Jacob Schiff. Actually, he was head of the U.S. investment banking firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company. Now, this funding allowed Japan to field a superior military effort and to win the war. Now, in appreciation for this, the Mikado awarded Schiff the Second Order of the Treasure of Japan. Nothing particularly significant about that, except to illustrate how important the Mikado thought Schiff was in the financing of that war. Now, to the real leverage point. A ton and a half of Bolshevik revolutionary literature was sent to Japan by Schiff to be distributed among Russian prisoners of war held there. He also sent communist organizers into those prisoner camps to propagandize and recruit those prisoners into the Bolshevik cause. In effect, ladies and gentlemen, at the end of that war, there were about 50,000 officers and enlisted men who returned to Russia as seeds of revolution and played a decisive role several years later in the communist takeover of Russia. As you know, it was the turning of certain military regiments that was critical during the Bolshevik Revolution. These regiments were effectively converted to the Bolshevik cause because of this propaganda activity in Japan, financed and masterminded by Jacob Schiff. Now, between 1905 and 1917, Jacob Schiff of Kuhn Loeb & Company also was the principal financial backer of the terrorist group in Russia called the Nihilists. Now, these people, these terrorists, changed their names historically from time to time. At that point, they were generally called Nihilists. They later became the Bolsheviks and later became the Communists every time there was a slight shifting or a reamalgamation of alignment of forces. They would change names, but they were basically the same group, and it was Schiff who was financing the Nihilists. Now, their mission was to assassinate heads of state, and this group, ladies and gentlemen, was organized in New York City. After Trotsky had been banished from France because of his revolutionary activities, he traveled to New York to meet with Jacob Schiff, and his travel expenses aboard the Monstrat, the ship, were paid by Schiff. After his arrival, Trotsky's mass meetings in New York City and his passage back to Russia were also financed by Schiff. After his return to Europe, several million dollars were placed at Trotsky's disposal by Schiff in a branch bank in Sweden. This is all a matter of very carefully, meticulously documented history. Now, on March 23, 1917, a mass meeting was held at Carnegie Hall to celebrate the first revolution. Remember, there were two revolutions in Russia. The first one involved the overthrow of the Tsar, in which a relatively moderate government came to power, the provisional government under Kerensky. And then that was later overthrown by the Bolsheviks and put firmly into the hands of communism. The second revolution was really more of a backroom, what would you call it? It wasn't a revolution at all. It was just a hijacking of a government. It was a very small-scale operation that involved very few people. But the nation was already frustrated with troubles and had no police force, no no military might, and it was total chaos. So relatively easy to capture a new government with a few people. But the first revolution overthrew the Tsar, and at the end of that there was a big celebration in New York City, of course, and Jacob Schiff sent a telegram to be read to the audience at that meeting at Carnegie Hall. In that telegram he expressed his regrets at not being able to attend, and then he said that he described the revolution as, quote, what we had hoped and striven for these long years, end quote. It is also a historical fact that Schiff was a primary factor in financing the second revolution in Russia, the Bolshevik Revolution, which overthrew the Kerensky Provisional Government in October of 1917. Now, in the February 3rd, 1949 issue of the New York Journal American, Jacob Schiff's grandson, John Schiff, was quoted to the effect that his grandfather had given about $20 million for the triumph of communism in Russia. Now, just think of what $20 million was worth in 1917, 1916, 1914. Now, I want to point out, ladies and gentlemen, quickly here, that Schiff was not alone. There were other sources of funding within the cabal. Leon Trotsky, in his book, My Life, tells of a British financier who gave him about 21 million rubles. This was undoubtedly Lord Alfred Milner. Now, we don't have time to talk about Milner, but Milner was one of the organizers and founders of the round table groups, which evolved into the Council on Foreign Relations here in the United States. And if you don't know who Lord Milner was, you better find out. He was one of these dark, shadowy figures who wielded tremendous power well beyond his station because he controlled both money and politicians. Anyway, there was no doubt that the source of this funding was Lord Alfred Milner. Now, other sources of funding for the overthrow of the Tsar and the establishment of Bolshevism were Olaf Ashberg of the Nye Banken of Stockholm, the Rhine-Westphalian Syndicate, and a wealthy banker named Jivotovsky, whose daughter later married Trotsky. In Germany, the chief source of funding was an international banker by the name of Max Warburg, whose brother Felix was married to the daughter of Jacob Schiff, and his other brother, Paul Warburg, later was to become the chief architect of the Federal Reserve System here in the United States. Now, Russia was teeming with British and American agents at that time. There was no secret about this. There were many foreign reporters and observers who were sending back communiques, many of which wound up in the American press, some of which were private communiques. Many observers were telling how Russia was swarming with Americans and Englishmen. And these people had suitcases full of money, and they were handing out money to revolutionaries, primarily those in the military barracks, trying to get to incite them to revolution. One report said, for example, that British agents were seen handing out 25 ruble notes to the men at the Pavlovsky Regiment just a few hours before it mutinied against its officers and sided with the revolution. Now, on the American side of this little operation, this was all under the umbrella of what was called the American Red Cross Mission. Now, I'm not casting an aspersion on the Red Cross, because you understand that the Red Cross is made up of many different missions and different countries and so forth. And it turned out that the American Red Cross mission to Russia was a very special breed of cat. It had practically nothing at all to do with the Red Cross. It was made up of men who were disguised as Red Cross officials on a humanitarian mission, but the majority were composed of financiers, lawyers, accountants, and their staffs, and assistants who were representatives of New York's banks and investment houses. The entire expense of the American Red Cross mission to Russia was paid for by one man, and his name was William Thompson. Now, Thompson was ideal for a Red Cross mission. He was a close associate of J.P. Morgan. and he was the director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Now, doesn't that qualify him to run a Red Cross mission? So there he was. He was in charge and he paid for it. I doubt if it all came out of his personal pocket, although much of it probably did. He expected to gain handsomely from his participation, but I think that there were others involved. Now, the assistant to William Thompson at that time, as head of the Red Cross mission, was a fellow by the name of Cornelius Kelleher. Kelleher, on reflecting on this episode at that time, wrote a book, and in this book he was describing one of the few dupes in the Red Cross mission who didn't understand what was going on. And he said, quote, "Poor Mr. Billings believed he was in charge of a scientific mission for the relief of Russia. He was, in reality, nothing but a mask. The Red Cross complexion of the mission was nothing but a mask," end quote. Well, what was the purpose of the mission then? It was clear. It was to channel funds into the revolution with local control on the scene by the men who were giving the funds, who could direct the revolution. As simple as that. Thompson himself gave over 2 million rubles to the Kerensky government and to the Kerensky regime for propaganda purposes inside Russia. He gave $1 million to the Bolsheviks for the spreading of revolutionary propaganda even outside of Russia, particularly in Germany and Austria, and this led to the abortive German Spartacus revolt of 1918. So it wasn't just Russia they were interested in. They want Bolshevik revolutions everywhere. And they tried it in Germany. It failed. And all of this was reported widely in the American press at that time. Now, when Thompson returned to the United States, he put a man in charge of the mission by the name of Raymond Robbins. Now, Robbins was the personal protege of Colonel Edward Mandel House. Colonel Edward Mandel House was in the United States, the counterpart of Lord Alfred Milner in Britain, one of those shadowy behind-the-scenes figures who wields great power far beyond his apparent position. Colonel House, for those of you who are not familiar with him, he came from banking circles, and he was the very private and personal advisor to presidents such as Woodrow Wilson and FDR. And he also was one of the engineers of the Federal Reserve System, which we'll be talking about shortly. In any event, Raymond Robbins was the protege of Colonel Edward Mandel House. Now, Robbins was a central character in a book, which I discovered quite by accident one day in a used bookstore. It was called British Agent by Bruce Lockhart. Lockhart was Milner's man in Russia. This gets kind of involved, but what we're dealing here with is two shadowy figures. In the United States, the shadowy figure is Colonel House, and his protege is Raymond Robbins in Russia. In England, the shadowy figure is Lord Alfred Milner, and his protege is Bruce Lockhart. Now, they're over there doing official work on behalf of the powers that be, but they're doing it under disguises, as humanitarians or reporters or something like that. This book, British Agent, by Bruce Lockhart, was an amazing treasure trove of information. He was boastful about what he had done. The first half of his book was mostly about his romantic exploits and what a great lover he was and what a good shot he was and all of this sort of thing. Sort of a Don Juan image he wanted to project of himself. But then in the latter part of the book, he got down to the nitty-gritties. He described some events that took place in Russia where he and Raymond Robbins were working together. And he said that at a particular meeting that he and Robbins had attended, Robbins was insulted by the nephew of Trotsky. Trotsky was a high commissar at the time. He was the assistant commissar of foreign affairs. He was a man of no small consequence. In addition to that fact, I should back up just for a second. Both of these men could command instant audiences with Lenin and Trotsky at any time they wished. Now remember, these are not communists. These are capitalists, right? Decadent, nasty capitalists in Russia. You'd think they would have been shot. No, no. Instant audiences with either Trotsky or Lenin at any time they wished, and they both attended closed meetings of the Soviet Central Executive Committee, which was the highest ruling body of the Communist Party at that time. Interesting. Okay, now, the insult. Robbins was insulted by Trotsky's nephew, the Assistant Commissar of Foreign Affairs. Lockhart describes how Robbins got on the telephone and called Trotsky and complained. He was very angry. He'd been insulted by his nephew. Trotsky said, "Are you at the hotel now?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Hang up, wait a few minutes, and I'll call you back." 10 minutes later, the phone rang. It was Trotsky. And he told Robbins, he said, "We've made amends. My nephew has been banished from Russia." Now, ladies and gentlemen, what kind of power do you suppose these men represented to be able to not only get into the highest ruling bodies of the communist regime, the new revolutionary government, but also to have that kind of power in banning a high commissar, the nephew of Trotsky himself? To ask the question is to answer it. Well, what did these men want out of the Bolshevik Revolution? What does the cabal always want? If my thesis about the master plan is correct, it wanted three things. The overthrow of the Russian imperialist government, which would not borrow from a central bank, and the establishment of one that would. Two, the creation of a hostile, aggressive regime which would threaten Europe and later the world with war. Three, above all, it wanted the vast profits that could be extracted from the human and natural resources of Russia. I personally believe it obtained all of these objectives, and I think it continues to enjoy those objectives today, although some of them may be a little more hidden from view. I'd love to talk about that, but we don't have time. We have to move on. Let's move on now to World War I. Very interesting study. It was the sinking of the Lusitania that changed American public opinion from pacifism to acceptance of the necessity to enter World War I on the side of England against Germany. It is clear now, the records are so clear, that the ship was loaded to the gunwales with ammunition and it was destined for England in violation of U.S. neutrality treaties. But what was more shocking is the fact that this fact was well known by our government, including President Wilson, and no one did anything either to stop it or to warn the innocent civilians who had booked passage on it. The German government had been sending notices of protest to the United States about the fact that not only this ship, but other ships were carrying munitions in violation of the treaty, and that this made them not passenger ships, but made them ships of war. As ships of war, the German government was saying they would become legitimate targets. We do not want to sink your passenger ships, but we have to because they are ships of war against us. The German government even ran advertisements in New York newspapers asking, pleading, warning Americans not to board those ships. Wilson knew it, many people in the government knew it, and as I said, did nothing either to stop the sailing of that ship and others, or to warn the innocent civilians who had booked passage. Why? J.P. Morgan and Kuhn Logan Company had floated $1.5 billion in loans to England and France, on which they were having great difficulty collecting interest. How nice it would be if the American people could be required to make these payments for them. But that would necessitate getting the United States government to provide the money. Now, the U.S. ambassador to Britain at that time was Walter Hines Page, who, in addition to his ambassadorship, was under private contract and was receiving $25,000 a year for spending money from the National City Bank in New York. On March 5, 1917, Ambassador Page sent the following telegram to President Wilson, quote, "I think that the pressure of this approaching crisis has gone beyond the ability of the Morgan Financial Agency for the British and French governments. the greatest help we could give the Allies would be a government credit. Unless we go to war with Germany, however, our government, of course, cannot make such a direct grant of credit. End quote. You get the picture? You think bailing out of the banks is just something that's happening in the 1980s? Author George Virick, in his book entitled The Strangest Friendship in History, Woodrow Wilson and Colonel House, that's the name of the book, was published in 1932, revealed that 10 months before Wilson was re-elected on his slogan that he kept us out of war, 10 months before that, his personal advisor, Colonel Edward Mandel House, had in fact negotiated a secret agreement with England and France on behalf of the President to intervene on their side, to get us into war. Now, during the war between 1915 and 1920, the U.S. supply of fiat money approximately doubled as a result of government debt to the central bank. The result, of course, was that the purchasing power of the dollar fell by about one half. That figures. You double the money supply, the purchasing power drops to one half. That means that during this period, the American people paid approximately half of the value of their entire money supply as tribute to the cabal, both in America and in Europe, and the way in which that was done is through a war. At the end of the war, the terms of the Versailles Treaty were extremely harsh against Germany. They created the kind of economic hardship and social unrest that always leads to the rise of a man on a white horse who promises drastic measures, including war, to cure those conditions and those ills. And Adolf Hitler became inevitable. There is little doubt, in my mind at least, that the men who negotiated these terms of the treaty knew fully well what they were doing and what the result was going to be. On the American side of the table, the man accompanying Wilson was his chief financial advisor, Paul Warburg. Warburg's brother, Max, was on the other side of the table representing Germany. It is an ugly fact of history, ladies and gentlemen, that American citizens were deliberately sacrificed by their leaders in order to get the United States into World War I, a war which would plunge the nation into debt, rescue a faltering England and France, and preserve the balance of power in Europe to guarantee additional wars in the years to come. Well, let me just cover World War II very briefly. There are many parallels. I'll just say this in summary. Pearl Harbor could have been averted. We had prior knowledge of the Japanese attack. That knowledge was bottled up in Washington at the highest level and withheld from our commanders at Pearl Harbor. Why? I submit the Rothschild formula. We had to get the United States back into war again. The American people would never accept a war unless they were attacked first. We set up trade restrictions, trade barriers so harsh against Japan that we knew the mentality of Japan would be that they had to strike us to save face. Not only that, we were strangling them economically. And you and I, if we're strangled, we will strike back. And the nation will do the same thing. The strangulation policy of our economic measures prior to the war made Japan inevitable as an aggressor against us. There's no question about that. We set it up. Now, as far as financing the war, it's clear that the financing for Nazi Germany came from the United States mostly and some from England. It did not come from Germany. Remember, Germany was almost a bankrupt country. It did not have the economic resources. From the very beginning, the Nazis were financed by these sources outside of Germany, the same people we've been talking about. Most of the largest U.S. corporations, which were within the orbit of the cabal by ownership or control through bankers on the boards of directors of these corporations, heavily invested in war industries in Germany, not just in making sewer pipes and telephones, but making warplanes, tanks, guns. IG Farben was the largest of the German industrial cartels and was the primary source of funding for Hitler. The brain and power center behind the Nazi machine was IG Farben. Remember, these concentration camps at Bitterfeld and all the others were not run by the Nazis. They were not run by the military. This was the slave labor force for the factories. And who owned and ran the factories? IG Farben. Slave labor camps, the concentration camps, were not run by the Nazis, but by IG Farben. And yet they had a few soldiers with guns to keep the prisoners in line, but the operation was an industrial one. Farben even hired the New York public relations firm of Ivy Lee, who was John D. Rockefeller's PR specialist, to help improve Hitler's public image in America during his rise to power. Most of the capital for the formation and expansion of IG Farben came from Wall Street, primarily the National City Bank, Dillon Reed & Company, Harris Forbes & Company, Kuhn Logan Company, and the Equitable Trust Company, which was part of the Morgan Empire. Farben interests in the United States were centered in a holding company called American IG. On the board of directors of American IG were such prominent figures as C.E. Mitchell, chairman of the National City Bank and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Edsel Ford, president of the Ford Motor Company, Walter Teagle, president of Standard Oil of New Jersey, the Rockefeller Empire, and Paul Warburg, first director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and chairman of the Bank of Manhattan Company. It's an interesting fact that during the war, during those tremendous bombing operations where we leveled many cities right to the ground, did you realize that the factories and installations of IG Farben were untouched? I have seen photographs where there is rubble, absolute rubble, right up to a street, and then on the other side of the street there's nothing except grass and standing buildings, and that was IG Farben. I have talked to people who have lived in Germany during those raids, and they said when the sirens went off, they didn't go to the bomb shelters, they ran as fast as they could to sit on the lawn of IG Farben. It's a fact, because they knew those buildings would not be touched. And this was by design. Instructions came from Washington not to destroy those buildings. Why? I suggest that maybe there were people in the United States from financial banking circles who had an investment in those buildings. For example, the Secretary of War at that time was Robert P. Patterson. James Forrestal was Secretary of the Navy and later became the first Secretary of Defense. Now, both of these men had come from the Rockefeller investment firm of Dillon Reed & Company, and in fact, Forrestal had been president of Dillon Reed. And don't forget, Dillon Reed was one of the principal banking houses which raised the money and put together the IG Farben cartel. Begin to get the picture? Now, this same game was seen in the cabal's financing and building of heavy industry in communist countries since World War II. The Rockefeller Chase Manhattan Bank financed 45% of the Kama River truck plant in the Soviet Union. The trucks produced are used for military purposes and currently are seen on the streets of Afghanistan, as previously they had been seen on the streets in Vietnam. The Bank of America headed the syndicate that gave $25 million to communist Nicaragua at the end of 1982, at precisely the same time the American people were being taxed and price inflated to oppose Nicaragua's subversion of Central America. Okay, I think you get the picture. If you will use the Rothschild formula as a tentative template, a possible template, and you lay it over the major wars of the last 200 years, pick any of them. Certainly both world wars, Korea, Vietnam, the revolutions in Russia, China, I skipped over that, but that certainly could be included. The first Bolshevik revolution in Mexico, did you know there was one? Mexico, by the way, was the first country to go to communism before Russia. Complete takeover. They lost it, they only held it for about a year, but they had it. In fact, the Soviet Constitution, the first draft of it, was in Mexico. The same people that wrote the Soviet Constitution had already done it as a trial in Mexico. Same people. In any event, lay this pattern, this template over all of these wars, And you will see that certain facts emerge in all of them. And you'll see that some points always align. For instance, ask yourself, how many of the revolutions overthrew regimes which were unfriendly to the cabal and replaced them with those which were friendly? How many of the old governments were peaceful but replaced by hostile and aggressive regimes which have posed the threat of war or internal subversion against their neighbors? How many of the wars ended in neither decisive victory nor defeat for either side? And four, how many conflicts were aided on both sides by the same financial powers? Five, how much government debt was generated by both sides in the conflict? Six, how was the fiat money created to satisfy that debt? And seven, who benefited the most from any of this? And the bottom line is that last point. The only group that ever benefited from any of these wars is the financial elite about which we are speaking, the financial cabal. Is the Rothschild formula at work today? Well, consider the possibilities at least in Europe. We have the threat of both conventional and nuclear war as a result of the Soviet Union, which was and is the creation of the cabal. It continues to be sustained by the cabal with the infusion of funding and technology. All of the verbiage and sound speeches and patriotic talk to the contrary, we still continue to send money and technology to the Soviet Union. So here we are keeping this credible military might as a potential enemy. How much debt has this led to? How much debt has the government incurred in both Europe and in the United States to oppose this military threat? In the Middle East and in Latin America, the threat of conventional war at least, and revolution as a result of aggressive Soviet satellites against their neighbors, how much of the military preparedness that is going into these potential combats results in debt, and how much debt to us and to other countries? Now, I'm not suggesting, this is very important, I want to make this clear, I'm not suggesting that the military threat of Nicaragua or Cuba or the Soviet Union is phony. It wouldn't work. The Rothschild formula will not work if it's a phony threat. It's got to be a real threat. There have to be real wars. Real people have to really die, and there has to be real blood flowing in the streets. So I'm not saying that you don't have to worry about these threats. I'm asking you to open your eyes a little larger and look at why we have these military threats and who is doing it to us. Once you get that larger picture, then and only then will you be able to come back down to earth and begin to think about what's going to happen in the economy and what we can do about it. But if you're still out there thinking that things are a comic book, storybook reality instead of what they really are, you'll never be able to make the right decisions because you won't understand what really is going to happen. That is why I've gone through all of this. Do we have a time of peace today? Politicians are constantly telling us, oh, we mustn't do this, we mustn't do this. We don't want to bring on war. We don't want war. We want to preserve the peace. Ladies and gentlemen, since the end of World War II, it has been one of the greatest eras of war the world has ever known. Today, no continent except Antarctica is without war. There are from 25 to 40 military struggles going on somewhere in the world every day of the year. There have been more than 150 armed conflicts since the end of World War II, with the death count around 20 million human beings and rising. 20 million human beings have been killed in war since the end of World War II, and these men have the audacity to call this a time of peace. It is not surprising that this also is a period of constantly rising national debts and the creation of fiat money. I would like to conclude our morning session with this thought, that perhaps the greatest lesson of history is that debt creates war, and war creates debt. They are transmutable one into the other, And that is the heart of the Rothschild formula. Ladies and gentlemen, let's return promptly, if you will, at 1 o'clock for the afternoon session. Thank you. I'd like to take a very quick look now at what the cabal has been up to in the United States. A good place to start is with the Constitution itself. Article 1, Section 8 says, Congress shall have the power to borrow money, coin money, regulate the value thereof, and to provide for the punishment of counterfeiting. Section 10 says, no state shall coin money, emit bills of credit, or make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. Now, emit bills of credit, in terms of the vocabulary that was used at the time of the writing of the Constitution, meant very clearly that they were forbidding fiat money, that is, any money that is not backed up by gold or silver. Now, why is that written into the Constitution? In a nutshell, the Founding Fathers had learned their lesson. Colonial America had gone through two devastating periods of monetary destruction. First, before the Revolutionary War, when the individual states themselves embarked on a rampage of creating fiat money. As a matter of fact, the first government outside of China, which had its own little thing going with papyrus earlier, papyrus being used as money, the first government in the so-called modern world that used paper money scientifically, so to speak, without backing of gold or silver, was the state of Massachusetts. All of the other colonies saw how profitable that was for Massachusetts, and they soon followed suit. The result was, in a nutshell, the middle class of the colonists was wiped out. People lost everything. They lost their farmland, they lost their personal possessions, and the speculators, the shrewd ones, are the ones that wound up with everything, and the little guy lost everything. And they had just learned their lesson, and then they wound up in the Revolutionary War. And once again, as we pointed out earlier, wars are very unpopular when they have to be paid out of taxes. And it is really questionable that the colonists would have supported the Revolutionary War if it had to be funded entirely out of direct taxes. I think it's safe to say that we would not be an independent nation today, at least not following the same path that we followed through the American Revolution, had it been funded out of taxes. So the young nation resorted to debt, and rather than borrowing from central banks, they started to print the money. The Continental was printed in great quantities. The statistics are in the syllabus for those of you who want to read them, but they're staggering, and it didn't take very long before that too had wiped out the middle class all over again. It was the next generation was wiped out. So by the time that it came to writing a constitution, the Founding Fathers, they remembered these experiences themselves, and there are enough people out there in the hinterlands who also remembered what fiat money really does. And they wanted no part of it, and they said that in plain English. This issue was thoroughly debated in the Constitutional Convention, and if you want to read any of those things, you will find that there was no doubt on the part of the great majority of the representatives that they wanted to prevent the new nation from having the power of creating fiat money. And they said so in about as clear language as you could possibly expect. In 1789, after this whole thing was resolved, the Constitution was in effect, and the nation was already embarked on a period of amazing prosperity. Prosperity the likes of which Europe had never seen, with all of its central banking. It absolutely amazed everyone, especially the Founding Fathers. And they said, boy, what a thing we have created. And they were feeling so good about it. And it was George Washington in 1789 who confirmed this good wisdom on their part when he said, quote, we may one day become a great commercial and flourishing nation. But if in the pursuit of the means, we should unfortunately stumble again on unfunded paper money or any similar species of fraud, we shall assuredly give a fatal stab to our national credit. What prophetic remarks those were. I would like to ask you to reread the Constitution. Constitution, the sections that I quoted earlier, the constitutional prohibition against the issue of fiat money has never been repealed. It has never even been amended, nor has its directive that only gold and silver coin be accepted as legal tender. All of that remains in perfect tact, and yet it is totally ignored by the politicians and, I might add, by the general public. Why? Because they don't understand it. They do not understand the history of money. They don't even know what fiat money is. They think it's French currency of some kind. Fiat is a car, yes, an Italian car. Thank you, sir. They don't understand these things. So that is the basic problem. Every one of our elected representatives have sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution, and you might ask them the next time you communicate with them when they intend to begin. Now I'd like to talk about a couple of banks that were formed in the United States and disappeared. Many people are amazed to discover that we have had central banks in the United States in our history. And the fact is, we've had three of them. I'm going to have to move through this very quickly. But our first central bank was called the Bank of North America. Actually, this was established under the Articles of Confederation in 1782. It was led by Congressman Robert Morris, who was a very prominent banking figure at the time from Philadelphia. He was both a monetary scientist and a political scientist. He understood fully the advantages of the Mandrake mechanism and intended to take advantage of it in this country. He had been to Europe and studied it over there. He was a good student. He had contacts with the Rothschilds and other segments of the banking dynasties in Europe, and he became an extension of that philosophy here. Under his strong leadership and influence, they formed the Bank of North America, and it was chartered to do all of the things that central banks are chartered to do. It was modeled after the Bank of England. It was privately owned. It had a monopoly over the issue of money in this country. It was supported by government guarantee to accept that money for taxes as though it were valued the same as gold. No other banks were allowed to be formed in competition. It was allowed to expand the money supply by pyramiding on top of debt. It agreed to create money out of nothing for the government's use, and it promptly created $1,200,000 for the government to use immediately and to collect interest on. Well, it was a short-lived experiment because the public was still familiar with the history of fiat money, and they were suspicious of banknotes, and they asked a lot of questions. Where's the gold? And it soon became obvious that there wasn't any gold, or at least not nearly enough to back it up, and the public stayed away in droves. Outside of Philadelphia, the banknotes were not very well accepted. Even in Philadelphia, they were generally discounted. And so it didn't take very long before the bank was in trouble, because if you can't inflate the money supply, if you can't create money out of nothing, and you can't do that if people aren't accepting it, then what's the point of having a central bank? Also, the political power of Robert Morris began to slip. Some of his shenanigans caught up with him. He no longer had his influence. And the first thing you know, just 1 year after the bank began, that was 1789, all of the government debt to the bank had been repaid. Now, can you imagine that? Within a year, the government had paid off its debt. That was a very bad start, I'm sorry to say. Glad our leaders have learned their lesson since. Anyway, they repaid the... I'm kidding, by the way, for the purpose of this recording. I don't want to be quoted. So without any money at loan, or any fiat money, funny money, collecting interest, what is a bank to do? It goes out of business. And that is exactly what happened. The Bank of North America quietly converted to a commercial bank in Philadelphia. And just 1 year after it began, the first experiment in central banking in America ended in a failure for the bankers. It didn't take long, of course, before the group was back again. The problem is that the founding fathers who drafted such a clear prohibition against fiat money being created by the government were not well enough informed to the complexity of monetary science to see the parallel to why a commercial bank shouldn't be allowed to create money out of nothing. Okay, they had learned that the government can't do it. That was clear. But now how about having a private bank and giving them the chance to have an elastic money supply to take care of the needs of commerce and business and agriculture. And you know, if you really want to baffle people, you can use a tremendous amount of vocabulary to convince them that what you're talking about and proposing is a very good thing for the health, the economic health of the nation. These people are good at that, and I have a mental picture of some of these representatives who were by this time maybe not well-educated gentlemen, but representing rural communities who had a basic wisdom and some hard-learned knocks and that kind of thing, but not being able to quite see the picture about fractional reserve banking. What was that all about? You know, that sort of thing. Anyway, there was a limitation against creation of fiat money on the part of the government, but there was a loophole in the Constitution. There was nothing said about private banks doing this. So consequently, this is the loophole through which the international financiers crawled into the American fabric. And it was this ignorance that became a very important thing, not only then but now. This factor of ignorance and not understanding was recognized by John Adams. He was one of the drafters of the Constitution, and he later became the second president of the United States. In a letter to Thomas Jefferson, it was Adams who said, quote, "All the perplexities, confusion, and distress in America arise not from the defects in their Constitution or Confederation, not from a want of honor or virtue, so much as from downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation," end quote. And I can only say amen to that. That is basically our problem today. Well, the debate raged in Congress between the pro-banking forces who had strong financial ties to the European cabal. Remember, part of the formula, as Professor Quigley pointed out in the very beginning, was that these people have economic rewards in the business world for compliant politicians. So it is easy to see how pro-banking interests are always very dominant in the Congress and in the Senate. It is profitable to be pro-banking. So the debate raged. Jefferson was perhaps one of the strongest voices against the Mandrake mechanism. In fact, he led the opposition to this whole scheme in those early years, and it was Jefferson who said, "I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous than standing armies." Now, Hamilton, on the other hand, was pro-bank. He was a protege of Morris, had worked under Morris for some time, and Hamilton was one of those guys who was a believer in strong centralized government. As a matter of fact, Hamilton's idea was to create in the United States almost an exact copy of what they had in England, a mercantilist type of system with strong government, high taxes, protectionism, aggressive armies and navies, war all the time and conquering other lands and converting them into colonies to exploit on behalf of the business community. This was all part of a package that historians generally describe as mercantilism, and Hamilton was one of its advocates. It was Hamilton who said, "A national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing." See, it wasn't Keynes at all that came up with this first, it was Hamilton. And he also said this, "No society could succeed which did not unite the interest and credit of rich individuals with those of the state." Unfortunately, it was Hamilton's views which prevailed. In 1791, Congress granted a 20-year charter to what was called the First Bank of the United States. Okay, well, those words again, words that don't mean what to say. It wasn't the First Bank, it was the Second. And it wasn't of the United States, it was of the bankers. And it carried the name of the United States so that people would think it had somehow a connection with the government. It was a symbol of the continuity with the past. The man named as the president of the new bank was Thomas Willing, the longtime president of the older bank. It was really the same group that somehow got back into power. Well, the result, as it always is, following the establishment of the central bank, was inflation. Creation of a lot of money out of nothing, flooding this money through the economy, money supply rising at a rate faster than goods and services, value of the money dropping, the appearance of rising prices, all of this. And the balance of power was finally tipped against the bank. The war over its control of the nation's money raged throughout that 20-year period following. And by charter renewal time, because of this evidence of inflation and economic hardship, and don't forget, people are still close, relatively close in a time frame to the memory of the old ills of fiat money. Yes, the older folks are dying off and being replaced by the new ones who don't remember it, but still, there's a pretty good residue, a reservoir of memory there. So the bankers don't have that easy a time in that kind of an environment. So what actually happened was an amazing thing. By the end of charter renewal time, the balance of the power tipped away from the banks. Under the influence of Presidents Jefferson and Monroe, the government had paid off all of its debt again and was operating, if you can believe, out of current income. So, what is a bank to do? Jefferson set the mood of the day, and he also put his finger on the Rothschild formula when he said, quote, "It is incumbent on every generation to pay its own debts as it goes, a principle which, if acted on, would save one half of the wars of the world," end quote. And he also said, "What an obstruction could not this Bank of the United States, with all its branch banks, be in time of war? It might dictate to us the peace we should accept or withdraw its aids. Ought we then to give further growth to an institution so powerful, so hostile?" See, this is not new, ladies and gentlemen. Again, hurrying along, the charter lapsed in 1811. And, of course, there were strong political forces in Congress and in the Senate fighting this every bit of the way, but the public and the majority of the Congress and Senate was still opposed to it because they could see the wisdom of Jefferson and others who shared the same view. Then enters the Rothschild formula, the War of 1812. Many historians have struggled over the sensibility of the War of 1812. It doesn't make sense. When you really analyze it, there was no excuse for that war, unless you lay the Rothschild formula down as a template over the historical events, and all of a sudden, everything lines up. Everything lines up. In the United States, all the wildcat banks were agitating on behalf of the war. Why? Because they were going to lend money to the United States, money which they created out of nothing, and they could collect interest on it because you need money to fight a war. It was a profitable thing to do. So I'm trying to skip ahead here. I'm doing that with confidence because for those of you who want details, there's a lot more of it here in the syllabus. I'll just say that as a result of getting into this war and these wildcat banks, that was the name given to the banks generally that were in the South and Midwest. These were the small banks that were springing up. You see, you could go into the banking business with very little capital. You just get yourself and a couple of friends together and you're a bank. The regulations and requirements were very small. They used to get these kegs of nails and set them out there in the showroom and then cover the top with gold coins. And people come and look at it, boy, they got a lot of gold in reserve here. And sort of the same trick they do when Chase Manhattan Bank issues its financial statement, you know. All those billions of dollars in assets, which are not assets at all, they're liabilities. But anyway, these wildcat banks were springing up and they wanted to be able to lend to the government. So it's historically a fact that the great pressure for the War of 1812 came from those banks. And when those banks did lend money to the government, there was the inflation, there were runs on the bank, the banks couldn't pay, and the government came to the rescue. You see, the partnership was already forming. Government came to the rescue and allowed the banks to suspend payment in specie.